begin with two images, two depictions by missionaries who were working in the Congo Free State at around the same time. Both these images are, roughly speaking, about 110 years old. Both images which relate to the atrocities that were happening under King Leopold II's rule, but quite different images in important ways. You might just be familiar with the one which is on the left as we look at it, or at least familiar with that type of image which comes from the Congo Free State. These photographs of maimed, wounded children were sent around the world as part of the international campaign for reform of the Congo Free State, and continue to be recycled in historians' lectures and in history textbooks and so on. The other image is completely obscure, I think. It was first published in the Baptist Missionary Herald magazine in 1907, and that's a significant date, actually. It's 4 years after the photograph was taken, so it took a long while to get published. And what we have here is a tally made by people in the Monsembe region of the Congo representing deaths. These are plantain stalks. Each one represents somebody who was murdered in a raid on their village. Never published again, apart from in this magazine, apart from in my book, which doesn't really count. So it's completely obscure. And I want to begin with that contrast. And I want to think about these two images, and I'll find my way back to them as I work my way through this talk. But to begin properly, I want to speak more about some of the sort of basic facts about Protestant missionaries in the Congo. Protestants first ventured to the Congo, the river basin, in 1878, within just a year of Henry Morton Stanley's pioneering journey through the region. Stanley ventured across Africa from the east coast to the west. In 1877, missionaries followed in his footsteps just a year later, travelling from the west coast inland. The Baptist Missionary Society were the first organisation to venture there in 1878, along with the Livingston Inland Mission. The Livingston Inland Mission was quickly replaced in 1884 by a different organisation, the American Baptist Missionary Union. 1885 is the next key date. It's in that year that King Leopold is granted rule of the Congo Free State by the assembled powers at the Berlin Conference. So everybody in Europe kind of gives the green flag to Leopold, claiming this vast territory, the Congo River Basin, which is, roughly speaking, the size of Western Europe. And once Leopold is formally given control of the territory, a new wave of missionaries venture there. So the next Protestant missionary group who venture there are the Congo Belolo Mission, who leave sort of based in London. And they created posts in the Upper Congo, vast territory which is beyond Paul Malebo, from around 1890. And then finally, the fourth Protestant missionary group that goes out there is another American group, the Presbyterian Missionary Union, who worked in the Kasai Delta down in the southwest of the colony. What I want to do in this paper is to range over these different institutions, but I'm mainly going to speak about the British organisations in the Congo Free State, the Baptist Missionary Society and the Congo Belolo Mission. And what I want to think about today is how evangelists working for British and US missions would eventually become vocal critics of the abusive colonial regime which emerged under the Belgian monarch's control. At first, the missionaries were questioned for their apparent compliance with the Congo authorities, but they proved in the end to be useful, well, crucial, really, sources of information in the international campaign for Congo reform. Documenting violence led missionaries, I think, to new understandings of their own work in Africa and to new understandings of the peoples and the cultures that they witnessed in Central Africa. Most of the research on missionaries in the Congo Free State has drawn upon these photographs, but I want, by the end of my talk today, to think a bit more about different forms of contact between missionaries and Congo peoples. And in particular, I want to think about the ways in which missionaries tried to record the Congolese's own depictions of violence, own knowledge of the violence that was happening to them. The pioneers, really, of Protestantism in the Congo were these Baptist Missionary Society members, George Grenfell and W.H. Bentley. They travelled there in 1878, along with Henry Richards of the Livingston Inland Mission. And these two figures really gained reputations as heroes of the evangelical movement in Africa, and certainly also as authorities on the indigenous societies of the Congo. They also, in Grenfell in particular, became known really as a bit of a sort of explorer hero in the mould of Henry Stanley, in a way. And one of the things that you quickly learn about missionaries in this period is that they were always really called into public roles beyond those which they'd originally gone to Africa for. They became public celebrities, were called into kind of public debates which they might not necessarily have wished originally to partake in. The writings of Grenfell and of Bentley were really, really important in securing evangelical bodies' support for the colonisation of the Congo at the Berlin Conference in 84-85. And these two figures' writings would continue to play an important role as the subject or the debate turned to whether or not atrocities were happening and on what scale they were happening in Central Africa. In the talk on Tuesday night, Bandy and Mbube spoke at some length about the ways in which missionary writings worked really to promote and to justify imperialism in Africa. And that subject's really quite well known and has been studied well over the last 30 years in scholarship. Through exploration, missionaries work to open up territories that would be occupied by colonisers, by mapping territories, they did similar things. Also, their writings worked in various ways to justify colonial expansion by depicting peoples of Africa as being in various ways in need of westernization. Civilization is the term which is used at the time. So frequently we see peoples of Africa being depicted as heathenish, cultureless, and in need of kind of spiritual nourishment. All of that's quite well known. I don't want to say too much more about that this evening. One of the things that sometimes gets forgotten also is that writers such as Grenfell and Bentley also supported the cause of colonisation overtly and explicitly in their books. So Bentley's book, a vast book called Pioneering on the Congo, published in 1900, comes out very openly and explicitly in favour of King Leopold's rule in Central Africa. And as a consequence of that, it would get dragged into the debate on the atrocities that are happening there. So that just 2 years later, in 1902, a different missionary, an American, William Morrison, would write in a letter that Bentley's book, he's sorry to say, is calculated to do a great harm in any efforts to alleviate the pitiable situation of the native. So that's quite a strong claim, that calculated. The suggestion here is that Bentley is writing almost kind of as a propagandist, really, to cover over the cracks that were emerging in the colonial mission in the Congo. Strong claim, and I think that it is open to debate. It's very possible that being based in the lower Congo, Bentley really didn't know much about widespread violence, or at least the violence that he saw wouldn't have been too different to what was happening elsewhere in Africa at this time. But what this quotation does tell us is that a conflict was emerging, a schism was emerging in missionary circles in Central Africa. Protestant missionaries thinking very different ways about how colonisation should be undertaken there and what costs it entailed. And that schism is a result of the Congo atrocities. So I just want to speak a bit about what the atrocities were and why they happened. 1888 is the key date here. It's in that year that the Congo Free State government imposed upon all of its subjects, all of the peoples of the Congo, these mandatory 7-year labour contracts, which were supposedly put in place in repayment for the cost of colonising Central Africa. So these labour contracts were, of course, kind of unknown to virtually all of the people of Central Africa. Hundreds of internally dynamic ethnic groups which it affected. But to the colonial administrators, the entire population of Central Africa was to be seen in effect as serfs upon state land and to be put into a kind of perpetual debt bondage that was to be repaid by labour, principally in the form of the collection of ivory and of rubber. Bandy was speaking on Tuesday about coltan being the key mineral which now is being extracted from the Congo back in the period of which I speak. Rubber was the key article. The colonialists harvested rubber by overseeing and organising an African militia known as the Force Publique, and they enforced the tax on rubber through brutality and terror. So where communities resisted this new regime, they would be punished. Military expeditions would be sent out to punish them. Unfortunately for the inhabitants of the Congo Basin, the global demand for rubber surged in the 1890s. It's just one of those unfortunate things. The invention of the pneumatic tire gives rise to this global demand for rubber. And rubber exportation becomes so profitable at this time that to maximise his profits, King Leopold and his senior officers sought ways really to monopolise trade as best they could in Central Africa by excluding free traders. So the name Congo Free State, as Bandy was saying on Tuesday, is suggestive of the fact that this land in Central Africa is open to everyone to freely go there and trade, and also to freely instruct with Christian principles. But increasingly over the 1890s and early 1900s, that was not the case. In 1892, the colony was divided into three territories, which had different trading regulations. So Leopold claimed a big part of the Congo purely for his own profit, Domaine de la Couronne. And then there was another very large territory called Domaine Privé, where only chartered companies were allowed to work, and increasingly those companies were almost exclusively Belgian. Other countries were being forced out. The rest of the Congo was open to free trade, but free traders found it increasingly difficult to make their way there, and they were taxed more and more, so they were being pushed out too. So to the various societies and cultures of the Congo Basin, these various oppressive measures spelt destruction. To commentators in Europe, they signalled an end to the freedom which was claimed to exist in the Congo Free State. We had this fusion of humanitarian concern, but also economic concern, which leads people in Europe to start to begin to question whether or not Leopold should be allowed to continue in his sole possession of Central Africa. The early ringleader of the anti-Congo agitation is a man called H.R. Fox Bourne. By 1897, Fox Bourne had managed to sort of drum up enough public interest to have a motion raised in Parliament by Sir Charles Dyke, and Dyke called for a review of the terms of the Berlin Conference. So whether or not it's because they're getting a bit jealous of the trade which is going on and the profits which are being made, or whether it's through genuine humanitarian concern, in Britain in the late 1890s, people start to question really whether Leopold should be allowed to continue doing what he's doing. What about the missionaries then? Well, in the middle of the 1890s, it was the American Baptist Missionary Union which began to make the first sort of public disapproving statements about colonial rule in the Congo. So the Americans lead the way, really, among missionary bodies in criticising Leopold. And at the end of the 1890s, it's the other American body, the Presbyterian Missionary Union, based in the southwest of the territory, who join in with this protest. In Britain in the 1890s, among the missionaries, there's an air of kind of caginess, really, reticence, or even ongoing support for Leopold in missionary institutions. And that, I should note, is despite evidence that British missionaries knew about the violence that was taking place in the Congo. The prominent missionaries, Grenfell and Bentley, who I mentioned in beginning, really continued to serve the colonial cause. They were appointed in 1896 to so-called Commission for the Protection of the Natives, which was set up by Leopold, and it was a six-man commission which was supposed to report any wrongdoing that was happening directly to Leopold. And it was made up of missionaries, three Protestants among them. But these were all friendly with the Congo government, these missionaries, and they're all stationed at vast distances from one another in the Congo anyway, so it was not an effective means for raising concerns. And so they really did nothing, and in fact were just kind of a tool for deflecting criticism. Grenfell's position in the Congo is summed up by the British consul, Roger Casement, at around this time. So in sort of talking about the impotency of this Commission for the Protection of the Natives, Grenfell said to Casement that the position of the missionaries would have been quite intolerable in this country had they protested wherever they knew or believed wrong to have been done. They could not have proved the crimes they often knew of in a general way, nor was it rightly their place to act as public prosecutors. And moreover, Mr. Grenfell added, it seemed to all men out here that Europe had quite forgotten the Berlin Act and had handed over the Congo country and its people to be the sole unquestioned property of those administering this government. So Grenfell was very much opposed to protests coming out of the British missionary institutions. And I will say in his defence that there was certainly a lack of government support at this point for the British missionary bodies, and popular backing too was more or less absent. So it would have been very difficult for the missionaries to speak out without any kind of government support. And it would have totally compromised their place, of course, too. Another possible reason for the British missionaries acquiescing with the colonial regime was that they did not really want to compromise their position as Leopold's guests in the colony. Possibly their silence was motivated by their own plans for expansion. Grenfell, for one, hoped that Protestant missions might one day link across the continent from the Livingston Inland Mission on the west coast right over to the Church Missionary Society on the east coast. For that to happen, the missionaries had to remain in Leopold's favour. So it's from around the late 1890s that Fox Bourne, the first leader of the anti-Congo movement, he tries to get the missionaries involved. He writes to them asking the secretaries of the Baptist and the Congo Belola missions to help, and they decline to participate. And at first, E.D. Morrell, who is the ringleader of the Congo reform movement when it comes to fruition in the 1900s, he too meets with resistance. He's told by the secretary of the Congo Belola mission, Grattan Guinness, that his society just doesn't have space to publish in its journal any atrocity stories. The missionaries state in the first edition of their journal that they intend to, quote, abstain from all controversial subjects. And the Baptist Missionary Society secretary, Alfred Baines, also declines to publish evidence of atrocities at this time. So we have missionaries in the field in Central Africa, such as John Weeks and J.L. Forfitt, sending him letters outlining terrible things that they've witnessed, but they're not published. Nothing's published in the Baptist missionary magazine until 1907. And certain very key eyewitness reports from 1903 never get republished, as far as I can work out. Of course, what all of that is telling is that the missionaries weren't acting in unison. There were people in the field who were decrying what they saw. And the Baptist Missionary Society's John Weeks, in particular, had been secretly supplying Reuters with material on the Congo, some of which first appeared in the Daily News, so in a big British newspaper, from around 1895. I just want to say a bit about John Weeks. He's an important figure and rather neglected, even in missionary histories. He first ventured to the Congo in 1881, so one of the real pioneers too, and spent some time in the Lower Congo, but then went and founded his own mission station at Monsembi, which he had to abandon in 1905 because of depopulation. There were just not enough people left there. It was a bout of sleeping sickness after years of really awful treatment by the colonial authorities. So Weeks eventually returned back down the river to the Lower Congo and stayed there until 1912, so a 30-year career in Central Africa. And he and some of his more progressive colleagues really became in that time very anxious about the role of the missionary bodies and their silence. So in 1895, Walter Stapleton, Weeks' colleague at Monsembi, he wrote to Baines And I quote Stapleton now, "It is becoming a grave question with me and with others how long we can reconcile silence on the question of the infamous wrongs to which these people are subject with our conscientious view of our duty toward them as missionaries." And a bit later, another reverend, W.B. Frame, writes to Baines again, expressing concern at what he calls a conspiracy of silence in the pages of the Herald magazine, and asking for, quote, 3 lines in it stating that he is a witness to abuses in order that he might claim the guardianship, quote, of the welfare of our people bodily and spiritually. So rumblings behind the scenes, a real desire among those people who knew best the situation to help. And the situation changes dramatically in the autumn of 1903. At that point, Stapleton, Frame, Weeks, those missionaries who I've just been mentioning, they put their name to the cause of Congo reform for the first time by guiding the British consul, Roger Casement, on his publicly very prominent investigative tour of the Upper Congo. And it's also in that same period, the autumn of 1903, that missionaries begin to break rank with their institutions by contacting Morel and Fox Bourne without the permission of their secretaries. And then, perhaps realising that the tide had turned, the secretary of the Congo Belolo mission, Grattan Guinness, published his own quite carefully worded anti-Congo pamphlet. So there's this sea change in 1903, and suddenly the missionaries become publicly anti-Leopold for the first time. Morel, as the leader of the Congo reform movement, his reaction to the missionaries was at first rather sceptical. He was worried that they might try to transform his movement into an evangelical crusade. So he's very clear about how the missionaries should record atrocities. He tells them they need to stick to the details, no overblown statements, keep religious sentiment to a minimum, if you will. And he really clearly favours the likes of Weeks, who conform to this style of reportage. So Casement tells Morel that Weeks, and I quote, "had got the truth, you see, without any paraphernalia. Weeks shows how very reliable the missionary sources of information are." Weeks first went public on the conditions in his Monsembi station in the West African Mail, Morel's paper, in October of 1903. And thereafter, Merrill gets this flood of letters from missionaries from throughout the Upper Congo. This real network emerges, providing all kinds of detailed information for Merrill. And really, I think it's fair to say that the Congo reform movement is sustained on the back of missionary evidence from that point on. The opponents of Congo reform accused the missionaries of exaggerating and of falsifying evidence. But the missionaries could, and certainly did, legitimately claim far greater ethnographic, linguistic, demographic knowledge of the communities affected by colonialism than any other Westerners could at this time. And in documenting the violence, the missionaries would go on to play a crucial role in securing the end, really, of Leopold's rule in the Congo. And what happens is, after Casement's tour, Leopold invites his own commission, a 3-man party, to go and tour the Upper Congo and investigate the atrocities rumours. I think it's fair to say that Leopold assumed that these people would come back and say, no, everything's okay, you know, the missionaries have been lying after all. But it was impossible for that commission to do that. The missionaries made it impossible for them. They bombarded them with evidence so that the damning conclusions of the commission would lead to the end of Leopold's rule. The missionaries also helped to attract the attention of other travellers, journalists and so on, to Central Africa in pursuit of new evidence of atrocities. So the US journalist Richard Harding Davis, for instance, travels to the Kasai River in 1907. Davis failed to see any atrocities, but he had a meeting with the celebrated Protestant missionaries, which left him in no doubt as to the truthfulness of their reports. So Davis writes in his book, "After dinner we sat until late, while the older men told the young missionaries of atrocities of which, in the 20 years within the last 3 years, they had been witnesses. Already in Mr. Morel's books, I had read their testimony, but hearing from the men themselves the tales of outrage and cruelty gave them a fresh and more intimate value and sent me to bed hot and sick with indignation." The literary critic in me loves that quotation. It's quite boring, actually, but there's something brilliant about that, the way that the traveller goes to witness the witness at this point. You know, he's no longer seeing the trustees themselves, but the people have witnessed it. It's kind of postmodern, actually. So the missionaries then provided very powerful evidence. But I think it's really important to say that the missionaries didn't just bow to the demands of Morel. They clearly shared Morel's concerns. And Morel may have exploited the missionaries' position in Africa and their ability also to reach new audiences back home, but the missionaries, in an important sense, exploited Morel too. Missionaries used his high standing to voice the difficulties of their own situation. And in doing so, they secured lots of public support for their work. And also, what we see happening in Central Africa is that the missionaries create new subposts for evangelical outreach by through the atrocities debate, really, by going to help communities which have been blighted by the rubber regime and giving them Christian instruction. So there's a really interesting fusion going on here of humanitarian concern with new proselytising efforts. It's the photographs by missionaries of the atrocities which we kind of best remember them for today. You might remember 10 minutes or so ago I said that Morel was really keen that the missionaries provide factual evidence and try to leave their emotions at the door and be very objective in how they went about recording atrocities. And I think that one of the reasons why missionary evidence becomes, the missionary photographs become so popular is because they're seen at this time to be that kind of perfect, objective form of documentation. Their missionary photographs were dependent on certain technological developments, in particular the creation of new light and transportable cameras. The name most associated with these photographs is Alice Seeley Harris, who was stationed at the Baringa Mission. And she took this most famous image, and I think also figures, although the quality of the next image is poor, she figures as one of those white-hatted individuals in this other image. So these images, as I said at the start, were sent around the world, became key to the Congo reform movement. Perhaps because they suggested a kind of objectivity to the witnessing. Mark Twain, in his anti-Congo writings, suggests a kind of objectivity to the photographs. He calls these testimony of the light itself, the photographs, which no mere man can contradict. It would be possible to stereotype the Victorians, by the way, in thinking that they naively believed in the objectivity of photographs. They didn't, actually. They knew that the camera can lie as well. And Alice Harris had to sign affidavits to prove that her photographs were bona fide. So there's the photography, which is well known. I want to move on and talk about another form of evidence which the missionaries produced, which were interviews with peoples of the Congo. And the missionaries did regularly undertake interviews with survivors of colonial raids. And they primarily used interviews for their own forms of analysis. So they would produce statistics on the depopulation of the Upper Congo by bringing together testimonies of African people. John Weeks, who I've mentioned a few times, his station at Monsembe was unfortunately well placed to do those kind of calculations. He had to abandon his station, as I said earlier, in 1904, the end of 1904, when a sleeping sickness epidemic pretty much finished off the diminishing population in Monsembe. And so Weeks sent to Morel a list of people who'd recently been murdered and did his sums and worked out what the population used to be and what it was now, and other missionaries followed suit. So we get this kind of quite precise statistical information as a result of interviews with local people. It might just be worth pausing in my speech to run through some of those numbers so that you have a sense of the scale of the devastation people of the Upper Congo at this time. So from Monsembe, Weeks reported that the local population had diminished from 7,000 to 551. The Lulanga region, according to Gilchrist, went from 25,000 to 4,000. Lukolela, according to Whitehead, 6,000 to 352. Lake Manitoumba, 12,320. down to 1,610, according to Joseph Alfred Clark, and so on and so on. Those, of course, those statistics are open to interpretation, but that gives a sense of the more than decimation of the people of the Upper Congo that was happening. By publishing and transcribing interviews and producing these kinds of statistics, missionaries highlighted their own local expertise. But they also, I think, pioneered a new style of representing the people of the Congo, which was much more about dialogue, about exploring the Congo people's own perspectives on colonialism. And it's really in keeping with that that we start to get images like this one, which I began the lecture by showing you. A local method of recording a massacre, which we reproduce alongside his own data. Weeks pioneered this form of collecting local tallies of murders. And perhaps even more interestingly, a few years later, in 1909, he supplemented his lengthy lists of murdered individuals with a list of the living in the form of a petition signed by local chiefs. It's one of the few surviving records we have of Congolese protest from the years of Leopold's rule. Historians, I think, have tended to neglect these tallies and African representations of violence in favour of the photographs. But the tallies were not overlooked and not discounted at the time. The Harrises in Baringa said that they had reserved their trump cards, to use their own words, for the arrival of the Commission of Inquiry in 1904 in form of the local people's own evidence. So Harris ensured that tens upon tens of African testifiers arrived during the three-day sitting of the Commission of Inquiry. And he anticipated and he reported at each turn attempted interference with his witnesses. Story after story of massacre was recorded in his own words, but also in the words of the victims. So Harris, for instance, in his letter books from the time, writes, "The chief of all Balima stood boldly before all, pointed to his 20 witnesses, placed on the table his 110 twigs, each twig representing a life for rubber. These are chief's twigs, these are men's, these shorter ones, women, smaller still, are children's," so on and so on. And the sticks brought in by people of the Congo multiply over the course of the sitting at Baringa, so that Harris records in his letter book, "Every witness tells of flogging, rape, mutilation, murders, of imprisonment of men, women and children, of illegal fines and regular taxes," and so on. "The commission endeavours to get through this slough of iniquity and this river of blood, but finding it hopeless, asks how much longer I can go on. I tell them I can go on until they're satisfied that hundreds of murders have been committed by the ABIR," that's the Anglo-Belgian India Robber Company, "in this district alone, murders of chiefs, men, women and little children, and that multitudes of witnesses only await my signal to appear by the thousand." So this kind of writing, of course, represents the missionary in a quite positive light, as a local expert in touch with local African communities and their needs. But the missionaries, of course, did not simply invent the input of the Africans who informed them and gave them their evidence. There's an untold side to this story of the Congo reform question, and it's the African kind of grassroots contribution to European knowledge about the atrocities, and that's where my research interests lie at the moment. Of course, responses among the people of the Congo is extremely varied. It's a huge region, and people react differently to the imposition of colonial rule. But many individuals and groups of people procured evidence for the colonial authorities, either on behalf of themselves or the missionaries. And often this entailed travel by the Congolese. It would be wrong to think that this is a kind of situation where you've got Europeans travelling to meet with static Africans waiting on riverbanks for them. That's extremely, very much not the case. The Harrises, for instance, claim to have gathered much of their own information from a local preacher named Mbilo, who, and I quote, "perhaps more than anyone we have, has travelled in districts where the people are cruelly treated." And later, at Harris's request, people from Baringa would take on an extremely perilous six-month voyage to Boma, the kind of capital of the Congo Free State, to give testimony at the trial of a trader named Raoul Valkalkan. another example, in 1905, another colonialist, Commandant Massard, faced trial for crimes which had been exposed by a missionary. And Basingili people went to travel all the way, 1,000-mile return trip, down to Bomar to give evidence. Six of the witnesses died on that journey. Their lodgings and their food that they had en route were desperate. And those who eventually returned home 13 months after their departure were greatly weakened by the endeavour. And the journeys that Africans had to take to give evidence against the colonial authorities were so long and so dangerous that it actually became an effective means of silencing them. Go and give evidence if you dare. People who travelled, African people who travelled from throughout the Upper Congo, must have done so in the knowledge that they might face intimidation, imprisonment, or other reprisals. And they must have realised that some of them, they'd probably never see their homes again. Clearly, the Africans' burden of giving evidence was far greater than that experienced by Europeans in this context. But there are some more positive stories which emerge from Africans trying to work with missionaries and giving evidence of atrocities. For example, in 1908, the African-American Presbyterian missionary, who's on the right of the picture here, William Shepherd, faced trial for libel in Leopoldville, having come out criticising the local company who were murdering people in the Kasai region. And as he went to face his libel trial, he was joined by 20 witnesses from among the Kuba people, travelled with him on an 1,800-mile return journey to Leopoldville. And so these people went to give evidence in defence of Shepherd, the missionary. And as a kind of further symbol of the internationalism that's emerging at this point against the Congo Free State, it was a Belgian socialist, Emile van der Velde, who acted as the lawyer in Shepherd's behalf. And what van der Velde claimed successfully in defending Shepherd was that he wrote against the colonial authorities, not merely as an outsider from the USA, but as a member of Cuba society himself. And of course, the presence of these witnesses at the trial was crucial because it corroborated this claim. Actually, it's very typical, but the 20 witnesses were refused the opportunity to testify in this trial. Of course, in retrospect, that only really tells us a lot about their potential as witnesses. So, okay, I want to move toward a conclusion now, which is that missionaries' narratives of atrocities changed, I think, the British mission's relations to the Congo Free State and to the Congo Reform Campaign. Having been officially in support of the Congo government, and having actually even issued a public address of thanks to Leopold on the eve of the atrocity scandal in 1903, the Baptist Missionary Society finally avowed the existence of the atrocities in October of 1905. And from that point on, the Baptist Missionary Society actually does an awful lot to promote the cause of Congo reform. It even publishes its own edition of the Commission of Inquiry's report in 1906. So the Baptist Missionary Society joins the party late, but wholeheartedly when it does so. And I think that might be down to the change in opinion of George Grenfell, this father figure within the Baptist Missionary Society. Of course, with Bentley, Grenfell had been a very vocal denier of the atrocities. But finally, as more and more missionaries wrote to him saying, you know, this really is happening, you have to believe it, finally he wrote to the secretary of the Baptist Missionary Society, Baines, "I really believed the king's first purpose was to establish law and order and to promote the well-being of the people, and that the development of the resources of the country was a means to that end. I regretfully, most regretfully admit that those who have so long maintained the controversy are to all intents and purposes justified, and that I have been blinded by my wish to believe the best. The recent revelations have saddened me more than I can say. Similarly, up till now I believed that this regime of hand mutilation is practically dead, but it's certain that these and many untellable sorrows are inflicted upon the people." And Grenfell finally became a kind of public critic of the Congo colony, although he continued to defend Leopold in the press by claiming that Leopold was unaware of what was happening. It was Weeks and the Harrises and certain other missionaries who ultimately convinced their more reluctant colleagues with eyewitness narratives, developing new forms of representation of the Congo peoples, including the photographs, but also those interviews which I've been looking at in this talk. They produced evidence of atrocities, which I think reflects a growing desire to offer social and bodily, as well as evangelical guardianship. Thank you.